for Prime Minister Liz Truss and her so-called mini-budget, with calls ringing louder for her resignation and whether there's a lifeline for the UK economy or not. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian and journalist Tony Gosselin joins us from London. Also joining us is President of the European Institute for International Law, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosselin, I'll first start with you. Basically, let's find out from you what is your explanation behind what is going on, especially when it comes to this mini-budget, which is now turned out to be a real crisis for Liz Truss and her premiership.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of sabotage going on within the British economy. We had a whole month during September where there was a leadership contest between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, and the promise that Truss gave to all of those Conservative Party members was, "I will reduce your taxes." Well, of course, they just were thinking with their wallets and voted for her. The trouble is that actually there is nowhere that she could reduce taxes at all, really, because the markets have reacted in the way that the only way they could, which is to say, well, if you're going to reduce taxes, that means that the government borrowing, it cannot be paid back, and therefore we're going to have to, really, I suppose, punish you and tell you that we want the government to be able to pay its debts, and that's what they've done. The markets have punished them. They've said, if you're going to be cutting taxes, you're not going to be able to fulfil your budgetary needs in paying all these debts back. The fact is, the only place where at the moment where Truss and the government can actually get enough tax in is from the super rich, and these are the one group of people and the most powerful businesses. The businesses are very good at not paying tax, by the way, but the super rich, as they get paid income in Britain, they have, you know, it's very easy to take that tax off them, and she was going to cut that. So I mean, it was a disastrous policy from the start, just built on greed from the Conservative Party members voting for her. But as I said, I think there's an element of sabotage here. There are some powerful influences out there that do want to see economies crash. We've seen it in many other countries around the world. Okay. Argentina, I mean, the list goes on. And what happens is, as those economies start to crash, because most people think, well, you don't want that to happen, but some people do want that to happen, is they are then able to buy up all those assets for very little money and make an absolute fortune. We're talking about the people like George Soros, international dealers and traders that can make a fortune on a crash. This is the trouble, is the international markets, particularly those centred in the EU and in London, in the city, and in Wall Street, are basically like a casino. And so games are played, and that's what's been happening. And Liz Truss has completely lost touch with reality. This Chancellor... what they were doing is they were trying to do things which just had no economic sense to them whatsoever. And so I think now Kwarteng has gone, Liz Truss is going to have to go very soon because she backed him all the way. And Conservative Party is going to have to find a new leader.
Well, we're going to get to those topics, especially the one that you say that there's maybe sabotage going on. But Mahmoud Rafat, if you can tell us in layman terms, what was so wrong with this mini budget that caused such a crisis, which has put into question the credibility of Liz Truss and her administration as a whole?
Well, which is appearing for us is the Texas problem and the bad plan, which was put by the government of Truss, and especially to apply the same taxes on rich and poor, which represents a big contradiction with the social justice and also with the logic. But let's say, or let me repeat, this is what is appearing. Prime Minister Truss carried the heritage of long history of bad politics and also big messy. Don't forget, the Brexit is one of elements we can say not endamaged, but somehow broke big part of the British economy. Let's say also the markets in UK are not stable at all because of the big potentiality of the independence of Scotland next year, which will be followed for sure by independence of North Ireland. There is lots of elements she carried them as a heritage, or this government carried them, but she did not work on solving one of these dark elements. On the contrary, her government put a catastrophic plan, especially economic plan. Also, the involvement in UK strongly in the Russian-Ukrainian war was supporting one side, not only economically or militarily, but strategically. That's putting the UK economy in the same package or the same bucket of the war. And when there are wars, we always see investors do not trust so much in such economy. There is big trust used to be in the French economy, which we no longer find today, because of lots of elements she did not create, but she aggravated the situation by the tax cutting.
Well, let's get into what the Institute of Fiscal Studies has said here, Tony Gosling, because basically they pretty much hit the target when they talked about this mini budget. They called into question in terms of where the money was going to come from. And that was about, £60 billion that the UK will need in spending cuts. It said that unfunded tax cuts need to create that money. But how will the UK economy be able to do that? Of course, we know in the books they have forecasted a certain percentage of growth. I think it was 2.5%. But they said at best 0.7 or 0.8% is how much the UK economy is going to grow. So that's a blatant piece of fact that's out there. How did Liz Truss and her former Exchequer plan to convince people of that, which at this point is a void now?
I don't think they thought it through at all. I think that they had basically taken a few lines from an advertising agency in order to get themselves into power, get themselves elected in the election campaign over the summer. But they hadn't actually thought about what the implications might be. Look, let me just spell out a couple of basics here, because there is this thing called quantitative easing or printing money that the Bank of England's been doing. It's been using that money that it's created to purchase government bonds this week. It's just decided yesterday it's going to stop doing that, apparently, which means on Monday when the market's open, God only knows what's going to happen. We could have all sorts of problems with pensions. House prices could tank, mortgage rates going up. You know, this is becoming much more expensive for ordinary people. What should really happen with the money the Bank of England are making it up is they should just gift it to people who are on benefits, people who are on low pay, people that can't afford to buy food or having to go to food banks. Give it to them. Give each one of those people who are having to claim government subsidies or Social Security or whatever £2,000, because you know what? They'll spend the money, and that will help all other elements of the economy. Because the way that they're spending this money at the moment is just going into the pockets of the people who have shares, and it's going in for asset purchases, and it's going to the rich, basically. So give that money, Bank of England, to the poor, and you'll see the economy start to pick up. So that's a really basic thing to understand. I mean, what we've had is, you're right, lots of instability. July, the Chancellor was Rishi Sunak. August, the Chancellor was Nadeem Zahawi. September, the Chancellor was Kwasi Kwarteng. And now in October, we've got another Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. It gives the impression the Conservative Party haven't got a clue what they're doing.
Exactly.
And it's very unlikely that they will come up with policies now which will help the poorer people, which is the poor are the only ones who will actually manage to pick the economy up, I think, and get it moving again.
Well, you touched on a very important point there. And Mahmoud Rafat, just plain logic dictates when you have a position such as that, finance minister or the exchequer, have different people fill that position three times now, and you're having the fourth person come into the picture, Hunt, who has varied jobs in the past that don't exactly constitute to him being an expert on finances in a country, I'm guessing. That's just a sign of disarray. And then furthermore, you know, a certain amount of time has passed in a very crucial period of time. That's, you know, you're rocked by so many different economic factors. How can, after all these people to have come and gone, for there to be a promise of stability in the economic life of Britain, so to speak?
Well, let's say it's not questions only of experts. Always the economy is a follower to politics. And policies impact the economy and the functioning of the economy in any country over the world, whatever to be the degree of democracy of this this country or this nation. The question is, and matters not left completely to experts' opinions. No, the politicians and decision makers who are not experts financially intervenes in lots of matters. And also, their policies they put damage lots of plans put by experts, and this is which explains also the bad politics, especially last decades, especially last one decade, and the policies were adopted by politicians in UK were completely in lots of situations. Wrong politics and wrong policies, which led today to this heritage I was talking about a few minutes ago, Madame Truss has carried when she entered Downing Street. While, again, the question is not only one reason. We have lots of reasons. United Kingdom has been accumulating lots of reasons to drop down today. It's not something happened last week or last month. It's bad policies, bad interventions in some areas of the world.
How far back would you go with that?
Well, let's just have a look what happened in the Middle East last decade and the UK intervention in last decade. UK did not intervene rationally as all as its history, comparing to its history of intervention. It's old colonial empireship, should have big experience. Uh-huh. How to intervene and how to act when there are conflicts, while okay. We found the UK intervening completely wrongly since 2003, even before that, since okay. The Iraq war.
I just want to get an idea about the time frame that you were talking about. I'm sorry to jump in because I want to now ask that question from you, Tony Gosselin. Our guest there talked about a decade, but then he went back all the way to 2003. Tell us if you think that this is something that's either been in the making for quite some time or something that the UK maybe never really recovered from based on the 2008 financial crisis. If you want to take a look at the origins of, I guess, wrong policies or what have you.
Well, I can be absolutely precise and say, really, the origin of this is 1976. That is the removal of Harold Wilson, who was the Prime Minister, by the army in Britain and the far right and the right-wing army in Britain. They kicked him out of office and replaced him with James Callaghan. Anyone that doesn't know about this, there are some very good books on it. The Enemy Within, I think, is one of them. And The Wilson Plot is another one. Very interesting the way he was got, because he was managing the economy for the Labour Party, for the British people. And ever since then, we've had then, of course, the Thatcher era began in the 1980s. And that, I think, is actually the start of finance capitalism getting a grip on Britain. That is to say, everything is privatized bit by bit. I mean, Thatcher, it was like every two or three months, another major state-owned industry was sold off to the international markets. And that meant that anybody in the world with a lot of money could just buy up British infrastructure. This was a beginning of the end, in a way, and what they called at the time Thatcher selling off the family silver. So now finance capitalism, whatever it is, 40 years later, has become absolutely king. Finance capitalism dictates the policies to prime ministers at Chequers at their private residence. Finance capitalism dictates which broadcasters are owned by who. And so the two main organs that the public have got to defend them from voracious, rich, acquisitive people, that is to say, a democratic parliament, right, and the press, are both taken over by finance capitalists. And that's happened with the opposition Labour Party too here in the UK, where we've got a so-called opposition party which doesn't even support ordinary workers around the country, as we're getting lots of strikes starting in Britain now, even keep with their wages keeping pace with inflation. Now, if the Labour Party can't even support that, they're clearly working, just as the Conservatives are, for the finance capitalists, for the City of London. And what we really need is a mixed economy where we have a government that asserts its strength, controls its infrastructure, and makes sure the poorest and the most or the least well-off in the country are looked after, as well as the super-rich. This government and actually the opposition Labour Party really only care about the super-rich that pay their wages for their political parties now.
I'm going to get back to that point, see if I can add something to that to challenge you. But, okay, we got about 5 minutes left, max. Mahmoud Rafat, so here we are, and here is the UK, and here is what they're dealing with. How are they going to move forward? What do they have in mind in terms of what anything that points towards some kind of recovery from what's happened? I mean, you have Jeremy Hunt that has come forward, and he has again made a U-turn. I lost count on how many U-turns have been made from the beginning of this. Two were cited. I think I counted five based on what Jeremy Hunt has also said. But how can the UK move forward based on your analysis to come out of this situation and for there to be some stability there?
Well, I don't think there is a magic solution. It's not a bottom we will hit. We will find a solution for the economy and we will get back the economic stability and the purchase power will get back affordable by society. I don't think that will happen in the close future. In particular, I'm repeating again, the question of the referendum of Scotland, it will be a big and huge earthquake if the Supreme Court of UK accepted the case and Scottish went to referendum, the big chance is to vote yes. And that will represent earthquake, not only for the economy, by the way, but on the whole life of the United Kingdom. But, well, simply, this nation will not exist anymore. The United Kingdom will not be the United Kingdom anymore, or the Great Britain anymore. It will be England. So there is no quick solution. There are some suggestions to be adopted on a very long term. When I say long term, it's not one decade. It's around between 2 to 5 years in order to get some stability. But that will not be, we will never be able to start on that until the decision of the Supreme Court concerning Scotland, and if yes, to see the vote results and what will happen after this result, and to start from there, from 2023, when the shape of the relationship between Scotland and UK has been appeared. At that time, we will be able to start some procedures and to give the case and the files really to the experts without interventions of politicians.
Well, you have to have a stable government to do that. And you talked about the Labour Party there, and you, Tony Gosling, and you talked about how there should be a mixed, I forgot the term that you used.
Mixed economy.
But the Labour
yeah.
Party says that the Tories have they've lost the right to govern. And they're saying that the Conservative Party is just going to try to cling to power. And if it does that, it's going to bring down the country with it. What other options does UK have then?
Well, look, do you want Tony Blair back? I mean, because Starmer is even more extreme than Tony Blair. So he also has lost the right to govern. No, I think there are some very simple, quick solutions, but these are actually taboo. But the simple, quick solution, number one, is what I said before, is the people's quantitative easing. That is to say, printing money and giving it to the poor to, in order to kickstart the economy, you know, maybe even give £10,000 to everybody with no savings. A very simple thing that they could be doing. And that would be a fraction of the money that the Bank of England have been giving to the rich over the last, isn't it now 15 years, is it nearly, that they've been, well, no, not quite, but a long time anyway. So the people's QE, give that to poor people. The other thing they can do is they can regulate the privatised industries, all of the infrastructure, the railways, the electricity, the water, the gas. They can just restrict that, and they can renationalise it for free. And once the government is able to set the prices properly, so that there's no racketeering going on in the infrastructure, everybody will be able to get on and make some money. So there's two very basic things. Another one, of course, is the bankers that were responsible for what we call the banksters for the financial crisis. Sure. The criminal bankers, they must be arrested and put in jail. I think those three measures would make a tremendous amount of difference and put the British economy back on track again.
With that, we come to an end, unfortunately, of this edition of The Spotlight. I'd like to thank Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, and also like to thank Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tarawi and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, faithfulness to the promise and covenant. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being faithful to the promise. In the Islamic lifestyle, we know that Islam has paid attention, or it has emphasized on being faithful to the promise that made. Even in the Islamic teachings, we see that the amount of laws that are applied to this topic, being faithful, or the verses that we have, or the emphasis that we have not seen such an emphasis in other laws of the Islam. For example, in the Quran, Allah says, وَمَنْ أَوْفَى بِعَهْدِهِ مِنَ اللَّهِ. The one who fulfills his promise, he is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Or who is the one who can fulfill the promise and be from the servants of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. On the other hand, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about the day of judgment, about the rewards, about the punishment, he says, فَلَنْ يُخْلِفَ اللَّهُ أَحْدَهُ. Allah never, never breaks his promise. So he never breaks his promise. When Allah, who is the creator, when God, who has created us, who sent us to become perfect, then he never breaks his promise, and he always fulfills his promise. Therefore, he wants us also to be someone who fulfills the promise. He wants us to be the mu'min, the true believer. And the true believer is the one, when he promises someone, he fulfills that. He is faithful to that promise. And therefore, we see that even in the verses of the Quran, Allah says about the people who are the intellectuals, they are those ones who fulfill their promise. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being faithful or to the promise in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that in the Quran, Allah, when he's talking about, or when he's telling us the signs of the intellectuals, which is known as ulul albab, his signs, the signs of a person who possess the intellect, one of the signs is that he fulfills the promise that he made. And therefore, in chapter 13, verse 20, Allah says, الَّذِينَ يُوفُونَ بِعَهْدِ اللَّهِ. Those who possess the intellect, they are those who fulfill their Ahad, who fulfill their promise to the Allah, وَلَا يَنْقُضُونَ الْمِيثَاقِ, and they never break their treaty. They never break their treaty. Therefore, even Islam says that the faithfulness to the promise and the treaty or the covenant, it is from the signs of those who possess the intellect. On the other hand, when we see the verses about the economics, and when we want to look at the main dealings, like the financial dealings, there we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 5, for verse 1, said, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أُوفُوا بِالْعُقُودِ, O those who believed, O those who believe, fulfill your uqud covenants and be faithful to the covenants that you have made. Therefore, it is necessary that if we want to apply justice, if we want to have justice in our life, it is necessary to fulfill the covenant that we have made. And there are many verses in the Quran which tells us about this topic, and it emphasizes to be faithful to the promise, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran's Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian has paid a visit to EP House, an NGO supporting patients suffering from a rare skin disorder that causes the skin to become fragile, known as epidermolysis bullosa. During the visit, which came on the occasion of the EP Awareness Week, Iran's top diplomats said imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights.
Imposing unilateral sanctions have become a modern tool for the U.S. to violate human rights. There are 1,300 EB patients in Iran, but Sweden refuses to give special bandages to these patients. This comes as Westerners have repeatedly declared that sanctions do not include patients and medicine, but in practice, they act the opposite.
The Swedish company Mölnlycke Healthcare has refused to sell Iranian EB patients medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation.
Iran has serious problems in procuring wound dressings for EB patients. These dressings are produced in Sweden, but the country refrains from providing us with the bandages because of the U.S. sanctions. Our center has filed a lawsuit suit in the judiciary of the Islamic Republic to pursue the problem, and we expect the Foreign Ministry and the administration of President Raisi to follow up the case because the lives of my daughter and other patients are in danger.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items. Tens of Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Swedish company Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran. Since then, for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%.
Iran says the West is taking revenge on Iranians by waging a campaign of genocide against patients, believing that the sanctions have become the backbone of the so-called American human rights regulations. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
A high-ranking Palestinian delegation has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Arriving from Algeria, officials discussed the result of their meetings there for reconciliation among Palestinians. Assad underlined the importance of unity among Palestinians as a source of strength in the face of the Israeli aggression and for regaining their rights. He asserted that Syria will always remain in support of resistance against Israel. Members of the delegation expressed appreciation for Syria's historic support to Palestinians, describing it as their safe haven during hardships. They said they stand beside Syria in this year's long war waged by the U.S. and its allies. Following the meeting, representatives of Palestinian factions held a press conference.
The president welcomed us in an open heart and expressed Syria's love to Palestine, Palestinians, Palestinian cause and resistance, as well as determination for this meeting to pave the way for a new phase of relations between Syria and Palestinian factions.
The most significant aspect of the visit was that Hamas officials were present. This is their first visit to Syria in a decade after they left, cutting ties with the Syrian government at the start of Syria's crisis. During the press conference, Hamas officially announced the restoration of relations with Syria.
This is a glorious and important day. We restore our presence in Syria and joint action with Syrian-based Palestinian factions and the Syrian government in support of our cause. We told Assad that we support a unified Syria and we are against any aggression on Syria.
The visit comes shortly after Palestinian factions came together under Algerian Reconciliation Initiative, in which they met and agreed to end disputes and division for the sake of unifying ranks in the face of Israel. Palestinian factions' visit to Syria reiterates the Arab country's pivotal role in supporting Palestinian resistance against Israel, even during the war it is facing. And receiving Hamas officials in Damascus is yet another proof of Syria's commitment to the Palestinian cause, despite Hamas's stance over the Syrian crisis and disagreements in 2012. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and 1 out of 4 of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily.
Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores.
Lots of tough questions. You'd expect it. I mean, it's quite right that people, you know, are concerned about what happened, concerned about what it means, concerned about the ideology that lies behind it.
A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalised this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology. Muslim activists informed Press TV that locals felt the police had failed to protect their community, leading to a fight back.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organisations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president Aristide, who is the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty has been regularly subjugated, first by France and then by the United States. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically. It made no sense politically. And basically, the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Bourza, London.
The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process and were cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open 3 schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats, one of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rebeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rebeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The four Geneva Conventions, especially the Third Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Walayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
In the limelight. Recent reports in scientific journals have shown that breathing polluted air in the European continent has reduced people's lives. Also, these reports have announced the premature death of about 1.3 million people in Europe. That is about 25% of the annual death of this continent is due to air pollution and cancer. Air pollution causes the increase of underlying diseases and cardiovascular problems, and based on new research conducted, air pollution is directly related to lung and also to other cancers. Pollution is reportedly linked to 10% of cancer cases in Europe. The main cause of air pollution in big cities is industry and factories, which play a big role in polluting the air by producing methane, carbon dioxide, fuel oil, and other polluting gases. Smoke and toxic substances produced by cars and vehicles also play an important role in air pollution in big cities. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world's media. Please stay with us. The website of the European Environment Agency writes, according to a new report, pollutants in the environment and at the workplace, as well as some natural risks, have a huge impact on our health and in some cases lead to cancer. With nearly 3 million new patients and 1.3 million deaths each year across the European Union, cancer takes a huge toll on this society. The economic costs are also enormous, estimated at around 178 billion euros in 2018 alone. According to the European Environment Agency's study, most of these environmental and occupational cancer risks can be reduced by preventing pollution and changing behaviours. Reducing exposure to these risks offers an effective and cost-effective way of reducing cancer cases and associated deaths. For the first time, the European Environment Agency investigated the links between cancer and the environment, reviewing the latest scientific evidence on air pollution, radon, ultraviolet radiation, secondhand smoke and chemicals. The report estimates that environmental and occupational risks lie behind around 10% of cancer cases in Europe. Virginijus Sinkevičius, the European Union Commissioner for the Environment, Fisheries and Oceans, says, the European Environment Agency report highlights that too many cancer cases have an underlying environmental cause. Stella Kyriakides, the EU Commissioner for Health and Food Safety, says, every year in Europe, an estimated over 250,000 lives are lost to environmental-related cancer. The findings of the European Environment Agency show very clearly how the health of our planet and the health of our citizens are closely interlinked. We need to work with nature, not against it. The British daily The Guardian sheds more light on this issue. The Guardian reports, scientists have uncovered how air pollution causes lung cancer in groundbreaking research that promises to rewrite our understanding of the disease. The findings outline how fine particulates contained in car fumes awaken dormant mutations in lung cells and tipped them into a cancerous state. The work helps explain why so many non-smokers develop lung cancer and is a wake-up call about the damaging impact of pollution on human health. Professor Charles Swanton of the Francis Crick Institute, who presented the findings at the European Society for Medical Oncology conference in Paris on Saturday, 10th of September, said, "The risk of lung cancer from air pollution is lower than from smoking, but we have no control over what we all breathe." He adds, "Globally, more people are exposed to unsafe levels of air pollution than to toxic chemicals in cigarette smoke, and these new data link the importance of addressing climate health to improving human health." Smoking remains the biggest cause of lung cancer, but outdoor air pollution causes about 1 in 10 cases in the United Kingdom, and an estimated 6,000 people who have never smoked in their lives die of lung cancer every year. Globally, about 300,000 lung cancer deaths in 2019 were attributed to exposure to fine particulate matter, known as PM2.5, contained in air pollution. However, the biological basis for how air pollution causes cancer has remained unclear. Unlike smoking or sun exposure, which directly cause DNA mutations linked to lung and skin cancer, air pollution does not cause cancer by triggering such genetic changes. Instead, those with non-smoking lung cancer tend to carry mutations that are also seen in healthy lung tissue. Small errors that we accumulate in our DNA throughout our lives and which normally remain innocuous. Professor Swanton, who is also Cancer Research UK's chief clinician, says, "Clearly these patients are getting cancer without having mutations, so there's got to be something else going on." He adds, "Air pollution is associated with lung cancer, but people have largely ignored it because the mechanisms behind it were unclear." The Financial Times also explains more about this story. The Financial Times reports, "Two important environmental carcinogens, tobacco smoke and ultraviolet light, damage DNA and create mutations that generate tumours." But the researchers found no evidence that PM2.5 particles directly mutate DNA, which prompted them to look for a different explanation. They found that the particles caused inflammation, which activated pre-existing mutations in genes that drive the development of many lung cancers. Professor Charles Swanton says, "The mechanism we've identified could ultimately help us find better ways to prevent and treat lung cancer in never smokers." He adds, "The next step is to discover why some lung cells with mutations become cancerous when exposed to pollutants, while others don't." Amelia Lim, another member of the Francis Crick Institute's research team, says the findings may be applicable to other cancers associated with air pollution, including mesothelioma and tumours of the throat and mouth. Amelia Lim adds, 99% of the world's population lives in areas which exceed annual World Health Organization's limits for PM2.5 particles, underlining the public health challenges posed by air pollution across the globe. Exposure to secondhand smoke may increase the overall risk for all cancers by up to 16% in people who have themselves never been smokers. Around 31% of Europeans are exposed to secondhand tobacco smoke, either at home or at work, during leisure, or in educational institutions or in public settings. Hans Breunings, the European Environment Agency's executive director, says, "We see the impact of pollution in our environment has on health and quality of life of European citizens, and that is why preventing pollution is so crucial to our well-being. Cutting pollution through the European Union's Zero Pollution Action Plan and a chemical strategy for sustainability, as well as strong implementation of other existing European Union policies, would go a long way to reduce cancer cases and deaths from cancer. This would be an effective investment in our citizens' well-being. Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.